you know, glad to be here. I think what you're doing is very important. I think raising awareness about this, having people feel not alone, having people, you know, realize that this is something very common, treatable, that there are, you know, better days ahead.
But to be fair, that's sometimes how therapy works too. Sometimes you have to have a few wrong answers before you find the right one.
Yeah.
If you could please just increase your volume just a little bit.
Welcome to season 5. Who knew we'd make it this long?
Drug companies that raise their prices faster than inflation will have to pay Medicare a rebate. And that's sort of a start in lowering the overall you know, cost of care. And of course they do admit that there's more that has to be done as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to be clear. I didn't want to misquote you know, the president of the United States.
Well, and like you mm-hmm. said, Amy, there's coping mechanisms for ADHD, right. And that's great for adults. Adults can cope very much. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the skills and they can do that for the most part. But what do you do with, like, in Megan's situation where you have a little kid, you mm-hmm. know, and you can't lower the workload? Like, school's not going to be like, oh, you don't have to get that done today because you don't have your medication. Like, they don't have those options and those abilities. Mm-hmm. And then your house is also disrupted because this child is being ADHD, which that's fine, but it disrupts the household. And, like, what do you do?
Right.
I mean, that's actually how he right. got well, his diagnosis. Well, I mean, and then I took him to a therapist to see, because we are having behavioral issues with him. We took him to a therapist, and she was trying to teach him coping skills, and mm-hmm. it was not working. No. And she was like, there's something more going on here. Can I mm-hmm. have you see the psychiatric nurse practitioner in our practice? And I was like, absolutely. And that's how he got his ADHD diagnosis. He couldn't learn coping skills because his brain couldn't even shut off mm-hmm. enough to learn them.
Right. I'm sorry. We weren't laughing at you guys. We were over here. We have this fancy, like, board.
Steven pushed a button and microphone. It made his headphones stop working.
Yeah, that's what I'm sorry. You're very serious conversation. Go ahead.
So, Megan, how did you end up coping with that?
I mean, we put him on medication, but mm-hmm. when he was having the behavioral issues, I did not know this, and other people may not know, but anger outbursts could be a sign that somebody has ADHD, mm-hmm. a child has ADHD. Mm-hmm. And I had to clear his room of anything he could throw. Mm-hmm. It got to crisis level. And that's why I took him to see a therapist, because I'm like, I can't do this. Like, you have somebody like me with bipolar disorder. So I get overstimulated very easily. Like, I have a hard time, and I'm trying to, learn to be stable myself, because I was newly diagnosed and was not on the meds that I'm on now. The meds I'm on now are miracle workers, and I love them. And so I'm like, I don't know what to do. I'm losing my mind over here. I'm trying not to lose it on my kid. And I clear his room of everything. And then I got him in with the therapist, and I told her, I'm like, I'm very open to medication. I'm on medication. And so as soon as he got on that medication, it was like a complete 180. Mm-hmm. And he said the reason he was having the anger outbursts is because he couldn't shut off his brain. He couldn't mm-hmm. manage, like, what was going on in his head, and his thoughts were going, he likened it to a monster in his brain. Like, mm-hmm. he couldn't slow it down. Now he does so much better. On the days he forgets his medication, he's learned through the therapist, like, ways to cope with that. Mm-hmm. Thankfully he doesn't do that very often, because he has a hard time in school. But for me, it was really difficult having my own mental illness and having mm-hmm. To try to deal with a child who was struggling themselves. It was a really rough period in our lives. It really was. And thankfully now, like, my youngest daughter just got diagnosed with depression. I didn't know, but she was having suicidal ideation and self-harming. And thankfully now I am in a place that I can cope with having children with mental health disorders. All of my kids do, basically. Mm-hmm. But like years ago, it was a big struggle to take care of myself and take care of them at the same mm-hmm. time.
Yeah, and
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, LaShawn.
Go ahead, LaShawn.
No, I don't want to take the conversation off topic, but this is a part of just my learning. Amy, mm-hmm. you know, have any thoughts around, or anybody has yeah. thoughts around this? Is there a correlation between? So there's depression, and then there is like schizophrenia, and then there is bipolar, and then like, mm-hmm. Like I have a nephew who is autistic. Mm-hmm. Like where are the lines drawn between, like, you know, all of these, or is it just not even related, right?
No, it's actually cross genetic, a lot of those. People with bipolar have slightly greater chances of either them or a relative having, say, autism, ADHD. There's enough shared genes that if you have one, there's a good chance of the others appearing somewhere in your family.
Mm.
So you are absolutely right about that one.
Fascinating. I mean, the genetics is fascinating.
Right. Mm. So like with schizophrenia, over 200 genes have been identified that might be contributing to it, to somebody getting schizophrenia. So some of those 200 genes might be shared with something else that would give somebody more of a propensity to bipolar. A family where somebody's autistic, some of the shared genes might influence a different family member towards ADHD.
Mm. Okay.
And then all of that, like, it's very, not very rare, but kind of rare for a mental illness to be solely and only genetic. So a lot of life experiences are going to influence either whether it ever shows up, or more likely how and when it shows up and how bad it gets.
You know, and this is where people don't also realize, going back to the conversation of prescription drug costs, yeah. when it comes to the manufacturing of drugs and the research, mm-hmm. the R&D that goes in with it, this is where all of it becomes a perfect storm. So we were in the beginning, I was like, you know, part of this also was open up manufacturing. Part of it mm-hmm. is open up manufacturing, because one or two companies are controlling the recipe, basically, right. on a drug and driving up the cost. So that was mm-hmm. one impact of it. But the other one was, in terms of R&D, who controls the mm-hmm. R&D? Because if there's only one or two companies in specific states controlling the R&D, you mm-hmm. talk about genetic testing, genetic outcomes, in terms of, you know, the efficacy of medication, mm-hmm. it all happens if you're doing it in a fair and equitable way. If that is not mm-hmm. happening in a fair and equitable way, then what you're getting is out of touch, off balance outcomes. So which means mm-hmm. you're getting one person monopolizing, and then also ineffective drugs that may not work mm-hmm. for you genetically, because they have not done, you have not used you in any of the research.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's one of the insane. Biggest pushes in research psychology right now is to get greater diversity in the research groups, because people of different races, for example, and sexes and genders react differently to different mm-hmm. medications.
Mm-hmm.
So like clinical trials and yeah. stuff like that, right? Yeah.
Right.
And a big push to include pregnant women, mm-hmm. pregnant people in research to see how these medications affect them. But like, yeah, a lot of it is controlled by the actual drug companies. They're running their own trials a lot of the time. And those are some good paying jobs for a researcher.
Big time.
And so if you're getting paid a, you know, pretty impressive six figures to do research for a drug company, they're not paying you to tell them their stuff doesn't work.
Right.
Right.
So that's obviously a bias. And then the government funds a lot. And there's an Obama era law that if your research gets any government funding whatsoever, it has to be somewhere for free on the internet.
Right.
The articles written, the data has to be for free on the internet. So absolutely anybody who wants to go check it can. And then, you know, big universities that have a lot of funding. are also a major contributor to the research.
So when the drug companies are the biggest source of funding for research, mm-hmm. what that means is that the research gets tilted in the direction of development of drugs, mm-hmm. and in particular, drugs that will be profitable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're not as interested in teasing out how different populations might respond. They just want to, you know, let's get the biggest bulk, which, you know, honestly seems so penny-wise, pound-foolish to me. Mm-hmm. Because if you can find that this works better for this population, mm-hmm. and this works better for that population, then you got two drugs mm-hmm. that could be profitable instead of lumping everybody together and your result is a drug that is mm-hmm. barely statistically significant.
Right.
And doesn't it get even more sort of ominous, too, when you did drill down even deeper? So not only is it that drug companies do not have the inherent incentive to sort of copy split their medication, in other words, mm-hmm. to fit a certain genetics, but then there's no incentive to really even care. Mm-hmm. You know, in general. So in other words, so, you know, not only are they like, oh yeah, I'm missing the point on, I could probably do better by serving an Asian population, like a specific drug that would work for them. But mm-hmm. no, but they're, mm-hmm. it's more like, I don't want this drug to cure. I want this drug to sustain. Like, mm-hmm. I, you know, like, so for in the 80s, for example, if you listen to some people in applied health, they'll tell you that Eastern medicine had the cure for HIV and AIDS far before America did it, because for us, it was more about sustaining the person's life, longevity over time, not curing them. Mm-hmm. That's what some mm-hmm. people say. So this is like, you could call it conspiracy theory or what, but they're saying that other countries, other, you know, in the world had better drugs with better response rates than America did throughout the 80s and 90s until, mm-hmm. and then of course now it's all equal. But the same can be said with blood pressure. The same thing can be mm-hmm. said about, you know, cancer, you know, all of these treatments. Like, are we really encouraging a society that says, I want to eliminate these issues in society, or is this just another? I don't want to go there, but I'm just saying there doesn't seem like there's motivation for cure. There's motivation to sustain.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's interesting. That I'm sorry, was I interrupting somebody?
Mm-mm, go ahead, Lilla.
You know, one of my issues is that you know, I've never understood why drug companies don't get behind better screening tools for bipolar so that they could screen out bipolar patients from their clinical trials of antidepressants. Mm-hmm. And so that they wouldn't have to keep defending themselves from the charge that antidepressants cause suicide, which it does, they do, or mm-hmm. can, for people with bipolar. Mm-hmm. But then it occurs to me, before I was properly diagnosed, I had somebody who was on a drug company's payroll, who was feeding me one antidepressant after another. And I suppose that's an approach. Mm-hmm. You know, don't get the proper diagnosis, then you could say, well, that antidepressant caused a problem. But there's this new one coming out that is not generic and is, you know, third tier. And let's try that one.
Well, that's why, you know, that's why Amy and Rebecca and I interviewed Dr. Nick Alexander Nicolescu, mm-hmm. who's doing blood biomarker research on the response, you know, medications, so which medications are best for you. And then very early on when Rebecca was diagnosed, Dr. Hoffman in Denver, actually it was Greenwich Village, he was actually doing the same level. He was doing brain testing in order to see which medication would respond better to you based on your, you know, your overall makeup. To me, that's the kind of revolutionary treatment that's needed in mental health.
Right.
Because I remember when Rebecca was first prescribed Zoloft and went manic, you know, and they say, well, you know, much of this is just trial and error. Well, we went through almost 6 months to a year of trial and error before we even got it like functional. And, you know, and she'll tell you, she'll say, I was a wackadoo. I'm like, well, no, you were sick. We were trying to get you better. But it was very tough when we could have eliminated all of this by using the resources we have in our ecosystem.
Well, now they have some antidepressants specifically for bipolar disorder. So I'm on Latuda, which is specifically for bipolar one, which is how I found out I'm not actually bipolar two. And once I found out, and I was like, it makes total sense because like in my early 20s, I was a wackadoo too. I had full blown manic episodes now looking back. We're like, oh yeah, my spouse was like, oh yeah, you definitely did. So it wasn't surprising when I got the diagnosis of bipolar one. But there's now they're coming out with antidepressants that are specifically for bipolar disorder, which is really helpful because then we're not being put on things that are bad for us, like Rilla said, where it makes you suicidal. Like what I was put on at 21 made me suicidal. So we are starting to see like a shift where they're understanding like certain antidepressants just aren't going to work for us. But like the education isn't there, right? Like I said, PCMs are diagnosing people and they don't have the education to say, oh, this is bad for people with bipolar disorder because they're just seeing the depression and saying like, oh, this treats depression. Let's try this. Well, then you have a really bad reaction and it's just not helpful. So yeah, we do need to suss out, like you were saying, as like, these don't work for everybody. These aren't being tested on people with bipolar disorder. And then we're just finding out in the after fact, right? After it's already out and it's just like, it treats depression. And then you have somebody with bipolar disorder that takes it and it's bad. It's really bad for you. And that's the only way you find out.
Right.
You know, I want to just say a word for primary care people who are, you know, who are the heroes. They are providing the bulk of mental health care these days. And yeah, you can get misdiagnosis from a primary, but the person who prescribed Zoloft for me was a psychiatrist, and had a doctorate in psychopharmacology. And, you know, she also had prescribed Cymbalta and Effexor. It's not just that you're not getting to see the right doctor. Sometimes the psychiatrists are going on old information.
Right.
That's true. But the research shows that there's a very high rate of misdiagnosis from PCMs compared to psychiatrists. So they just don't have the training, which isn't necessarily their fault because they're training PCMs to like look at a wide spectrum of things. I think part of it is people can't see a psychiatrist because they can't afford it. The other part is you have PCMs who don't refer out to psychiatrists even when they can, which they need to, I think PCMs need to know what they can and cannot do. Like we were talking about therapists, need to know, I specialize in this. I have no idea what that is. I think PCMs need to know the same thing as like, I specialize in this, but I have no idea what that is. So if they can refer out to a psychiatrist, I think it's important because the research does back up that there is a very high rate of misdiagnosis from PCMs.
I mean, even with professional therapists, like the rate of accurate diagnosis is 70% in somebody who is considered a master in their field, like the best of the best, diagnose accurately early on in treatment 7 out of 10 times. Mm-hmm. So it is very, very complicated. And sometimes it's strange because, like, at the clinic I work at, they give people a few screeners just when they come in. Automatically, everybody gets an ADHD screener, everybody gets an anxiety screener, a couple others, just like the one page just to tell us if there's anything more there we need to look at. But, you know, sometimes, like a couple of times I've diagnosed an ADHD in an adult and the first clues were just like lifelong low-grade depression and anxiety along with, you know, like their career, their work ability not matching their intelligence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're not even, nobody was even looking at ADHD. Mm-hmm. And I'm just seeing this other, like the side effects of ADHD. And I'm like, you know, okay, you know, can I run an ADHD test past you? And so that's kind of one of the ways that ADHD actually shows up in adults who've never been diagnosed before. You're looking at like, okay, this is an intelligent person who has consistently not lived up to their potential, like their whole life. And they've got kind of just low grade, they can still function, but they're not very happy, anxiety and depression kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that has become a trigger for me to look deeper into like, if they have any kind of neurodiversity that has never before been diagnosed or treated. So that's before I ever think to get the DSM out or pull out some tests. So diagnosis is a really sideways kind of art. And there's a reason I refer to it as an art and not specifically a science.
You know, it's interesting you talk about, you know, that from an mm-hmm. internal perspective. Have you talked to your colleagues in like Canada and the United Kingdom and Europe, how they approach?
I mean, that would be interesting. I haven't so much, but it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Like some people are going to come in and say, I think I might have ADHD. Mm-hmm. Let's do some tests. Let's take a look at this. Some people have a sense of it and they've just never, for whatever reason, acted on it before. Other people, they're just like, you know, I'm a little depressed. I'm a little anxious. Okay. And like a lot of times trauma diagnosis works the same way. They don't come in for trauma necessarily. They come in for some other thing. And that, but you know, they react to that other life event in such a way that kind of, you know, makes some bells go off. Mm-hmm. You look a little deeper.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how I was diagnosed. We went in for something completely different than, I mean, we never would have thought.
I mean, you think how haphazard it all still is.
Yeah, it really is.
Subjective. And that was what I was getting ready to say. Like, mm-hmm. the subjective part of it.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, and also bipolar 2 in women is mm-hmm. often misdiagnosed instead of autism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes there's even a diagnostic sense, like this is usually what it feels like to me to be around a person with this diagnosis, and that might be the first thing that triggers me to ask a few more questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So if I know what they think the problem might be, and we can go straight to the DSM and then to the other things beyond that, you know, sometimes that's how diagnosis works. Sometimes somebody comes in with an idea of what they might have and we can go straight to that. But other times, this doesn't feel like depression. This feels more like what it's around to be like to be around somebody with bipolar or mm-hmm. something else.
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, they've got this thing going on in their life, but what might be behind that? So.
Right.
I mean, I think part of it is knowing the right questions to ask, right?
Yeah.
Because if you know, if you're familiar with it, you know the right questions to ask. Like when I got diagnosed, she was able to pick up on things that other people weren't because she knew what to ask of like of me and the experiences I've had. And she followed the breadcrumbs and was like, oh, this is not depression like they think it is. Like this is bipolar disorder. And I was like, no, it's not. She was like, please do me a favor and just go and research this and try this medication. If it doesn't work, come back. She's like, but I am pretty confident you have bipolar disorder. And I went home and researched it. I'm like, check, 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 check. That's all me. I went through that. But she had familiarity and knew the right questions to ask, right? Mm-hmm. Like went with, like, you're talking about, like, that instinct of, like, this is not what it presents to be.
Mm-hmm. But it's still kind of scary that you know, it's great that there are enough people who have kind of that instinct, that sense, and that, you know, comes a lot with experience. But it's still kind of scary that we're at such an early point in the existence of this field that diagnosis is kind of that haphazard. And so looking for, like, people like Dr. Niculescu who are looking for ways to make diagnosis more precise. This is somebody that we interviewed a few months ago on the podcast, who's trying to find a way to use blood tests to diagnose. Think how much that would cut through. I'd be a little sad because sometimes diagnosis is my favorite part. It's the Sherlocky part, but
yeah,
it would sure be much, much better for the field as a whole if that could work.
Well, and I think it would also help the patient in the way of, you know, you would feel less like a guinea pig if you could come out of, you know, a doctor's visit, take a blood draw, get a report, and have more knowledge of what is going on inside your brain rather than we think it's this, try this medication. Oh, that didn't work. Try this medication, you know, because it really is a guinea pig kind of game until you figure out what you got going on for you. And then you have the poor people who are medication resistant. And so it doesn't matter what you put them on. It's not working. They have no options.
Right.
I call it the chemistry experiment. And we're the
test. For real.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it. And then there's situations where maybe a medical problem is actually causing it.
Yep.
That's true. Like a thyroid or something like that.
Yeah. I've been, unless somebody's really sure of their diagnosis, they know their meds, they're coming in with a lot of experience. A lot of times, you know, I'm asking people, like, you know, when was the last time you were at the doctor? When was the last time you just had a basic nutritional panel, basic blood test to check for other things? And the only reason I do that is because many years ago, I had a friend who had a brain infection and it showed up exactly like an anxiety attack. The only clue was it came on very, very suddenly. And so he spent, you know, 6 months bouncing around trying to figure out what was wrong because it looked exactly like a psych problem. So it was treated like a psych problem. And then eventually somebody clued into the fact that there'd been an infection raging in his head for 6 months. So there's a lot going on in diagnosis. One of the reasons I moved to the practice that I did is because they have prescribers there. It's not just therapists. So, you know, I can, you know, email somebody, message somebody and be like, you know, hey, next time you're seeing this patient, any chance we could get a blood test?
Yeah, it as this conversation is going on, it just rings clear to me that it is important to have a community of people who can help you advocate for yourself, right? Because people go to the doctor, they rely heavily on their primary care physician. And, you know, Megan, as you've said several times, like they, you know, a lot of primary care physicians try to be an expert in every area, which they're not. And, you know, it's only to the deficit of the patient. And so people who have, you know, any type of, you know, mental illness or whatever issue can't always advocate on, you know, on their own behalf. And so it's like, if you don't have a family member, a partner, or, you know, whomever to, you know, help you through that process, it's just, you end up like in all of these different directions that are not necessarily helpful to your situation. So, advocacy is just really a big thing.
And advocacy and that education part of advocacy too. Because like you said, I mean, you could be sitting there with a thyroid issue and it could be treating you for some sort of mental health issue and it's not working or vice versa, you know? And it's just so important It's just so I cannot argue enough that it starts along the entire supply chain, you know, mm-hmm. from academia all the way into practice.
It does. Mm-hmm. And there's also something to be said about second opinions, too.
Second and thirds. That's absolutely it.
Yeah.
You know, if you go somewhere and they tell you something and it just doesn't feel right, like there's nothing wrong with going somewhere else and double checking mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and getting that second opinion to see, mm-hmm. you know, what other people think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people need to be comfortable, like trust that process, mm-hmm. like be comfortable enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just think about like Eugene and I's grandmother, who she swore by her primary care physician and, you know, whatever he said was like Bible. Now, this is nothing against primary care physicians because they do good work. We all know that. But it's, again, about knowing, it's about being educated, about knowing that you can, that you should do your due diligence as a patient to, you know, get the second opinion or whatever, you know, just to, you know, for educational purposes, and then to know, you know, whatever that informed step is that you should take next. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes people have people are so comfortable with their primary care physicians that they don't feel comfortable going outside of, you know, mm-hmm. or going to another
mm-hmm.
doctor who specializes in something to, you know, get educated on stuff. So
it's also very frightening. I mean, I remember the first time that I saw a psychiatrist or therapist or anything like that. Like, it's a little mm-hmm. scary. You don't know what you're walking into, you know, mm-hmm. and they're throwing all these charts at you and these little tests. And it's mm-hmm. like you want to make sure that you're answering correctly, but you don't know what the right answer is. And mm-hmm. it can be overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
people are sometimes afraid of what the real outcome is going, like, right? What they're going to hear.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think mm-hmm. LaShawn, what you're saying about community is just crucial. That, and gosh, I know so many people are unchurched these days, and church isn't always the place that is willing to take up that task.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I wouldn't have survived if I weren't married mm-hmm. to somebody who had some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody is married, and not everybody is married to somebody who has some sense. But whatever the community is, I don't know, maybe bowling clubs ought to have you know, we need to be planting people in whatever community people are in,
mm-hmm.
who are willing to take up that task. Mm-hmm. I will go to the psychiatrist with you.
Right.
You think your psychiatrist is gaslighting you, I will go with you and give mm-hmm. you my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's,
or even like,
it is,
oh,
so,
go ahead.
I was going to say, it's so important from the caregiver's perspective that you guys just made this point. Because when Rebecca was on Latuda, and this is during a time where, I swear to you, I told Rebecca, I said, I didn't know what was going on, but I thought you were literally getting ready to pack your bags and leave. She was not present. And when I found out she had switched to Latuda.
You knew that I had switched because we had discussed it.
Yeah, but it didn't resonate because normally she and I collaborate and I go through the process with her. But I'd been working so much. I just forgot about Latuda. That's why I don't like Latuda. Latuda, personally.
Latuda's not friendly with Steven.
We are not friends. We're not best friends. We're not going to. We're not having wine and cheese parties. You know, we're not going to be talking about liberal blind spots over red wine. No. Latuda is out.
No bashing on my best friend over here. that saved my life last year.
So, but see, you see the difference.
But see, it's mm-hmm. it's that difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is what frustrates me a lot of times in, like, and Megan, you know this, and so does Willa, in the bipolar groups. Like, they're like, I've been put on Latuda. Does it work? And it's like, well, no, it doesn't work for me. But then Megan's sitting there like, it saved my life. So,
right.
you know, and you can't do that. And that's why in all those conversations, I'm like, everybody is different. Like, you can't base it off of what somebody else is saying about this medication, because you don't know how you're going to react to it.
And before we made it to Dr. Sharma, her therapist, her psychiatrist before told her to just forget about
it. Was in my head.
It was in her head. Can you imagine?
Which it was. That's where it lives.
Of course, that's where it lives, right?
The brain.
Well, I mean, you're not wrong, but you're epically wrong.
Right, yeah, exactly.
She told me, she was like, I think you're getting yourself worked up about this, and I think if you would just stop thinking about it so much, you would calm down. And I'm like... And Steven's just sitting there bug-eyed. He's like, oh, no.
I told him, I said, hang up the damn phone. I'm pantomiming. Hang it up. Like, we'll find someone else.
We'll find someone else. And we did. And he put me back on Lamictal. And, you know, now I'm on a concoction that works. But I thought everything was fine. Like, I didn't think there was a problem with me being on Latuda. I felt fine. But I, like... was a little bit of a zombie and conked out and wasn't really present and had like no empathy. Like I could have cared less about anybody else.
None.
But to me, like I was fine. I wasn't swinging. I wasn't manic. I wasn't depressed. Mm-hmm. I was good. But if it hadn't been for Steven, you know, saying that this is not the way my wife reacts to mm-hmm. things and this is not the way her personality and things like that, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't have someone advocating for you like that, you can go years and years.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the flip side to that, because I always like to tell this with my brother. My brother is diagnosed with bipolar 2, but he's unmedicated. And the reason mm-hmm. he's unmedicated is because he went to the hospital and they put him on lithium. And when he was on lithium, the rest of us thought that he was good. We were like, you're good. You know, you seem stable. You seem happy again. And he's like, I am a zombie. He's like, I have so much anxiety right now. He's like, I could strangle you and not feel a thing about it. And he just couldn't survive on this lithium anymore. And so he came off of it and refused to go on another drug. Mm-hmm. So he self-medicates, and that's a whole nother thing. But it's like, you know, you get one bad experience with a medication, and with somebody like my brother, like, that's it. We're done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Men are just hard.
So speaking of treatments and the need for innovation, we should probably head towards moving on to the discussion of hallucinogens. Anybody want to wrap us up and segue us into hallucinogens?
I don't know. I feel like I should play Manic Depression or like some like Jimi Hendrix song. I don't have one right now, but
well, so I listened to the APA Speaking of Psychology podcast. So that's mm-hmm. the American Psychological Association for mm-hmm. anybody who doesn't know what APA is. And they actually had somebody on to talk about hallucinogens. And they're doing a lot of research on that for depression, which is mm-hmm. actually, according to his research, has been really, really helpful. He did give a warning about people with bipolar disorder. He did mm-hmm. say it can cause you to go manic. Mm-hmm. So it needs to, he said, if you're going to try it and you have bipolar disorder, you need to be really careful because it's not as effective as it is for those that just have like major mm-hmm. depressive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And it could actually be dangerous.
It could be dangerous, yeah. especially if you administer it yourself. Now, with ketamine, mm-hmm. it is administered by a doctor. Mm-hmm. You go to your doctor's office. They do right. a infusion through mm-hmm. your veins, and you get, like, one woman said she had to go 3 times in 3 weeks, and then, like, it's once every, like, 3 months after that.
Right.
Right. And
the first appointment is usually like a very, very small dose just to see if you're going to mm-hmm. react well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And mm-hmm. she says that it saved her life. She's mm-hmm. nothing worked for her. And she's one of those who was medically, you know, who was medication resistant. Nothing was mm-hmm. working for her. And her doctor was like, mm-hmm. well, let's try this.
So yeah. I have a friend of mine who I was very close to. When I lived in Southern California, his name is David Nikzad, Nikzad. And he started out in the flooring business, but he got into like alternate treatments for mental health issues because he had ADHD. He had all these chronic issues. He couldn't focus in school, and his parents had resources. Like they had the financial resources, but none of them were working. And as he started getting older, he started realizing that that these alternatives were best choice. And Rebecca and I actually listened to a panel he sat on. He went down to Miami or wherever it was, really promoting it because people are skeptical in the mental health community and in the health community about whether psychedelics and, for example, and all of these other alternative treatments will actually work. But he's like, it's emerging and it's going to boom and it's really going to change people's lives because sometimes that medication has oppressive, sometimes medications have an oppressive effect on certain bodies. And we were talking about the genetics, right? But they're saying that there's less of this impact when it comes to like using like mushrooms or psychedelics and, you know, to treat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say you, Amy, from the clinical side.
I've actually recommended a couple of clients, you know, when we tried everything, their psychiatrist had tried everything. You know, I talked a little bit with them about ketamine. Since it's a hallucinogen, it's not something I would ever push. Like, yeah, go do the ketamine. But here might be another option that has helped some people who maybe haven't responded to other treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's something where I would be a lot more, you know, lower pressure, less directive. Not that I'm ever particularly pressuring on clients, but here is one option that we could talk about and maybe you could try. And the nice thing about it is, you know, the first dose is going to be just a tiny, tiny bit to see how you'll react and make sure you're not going to trip bad.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it has a big advantage over other psych meds.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because you can take that little dose to just to see if it's safe for you. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, sometimes they'll be still be feeling the effects when they come to therapy and they'll have these interesting new insights. So I've been looking more into a little bit, you know, I'm definitely not expert at it yet, but, how to actually do therapy with somebody who's maybe just come from their ketamine treatment.
Right.
Or it's still affecting them. But let's say I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic about it.
And Megan, did they say how new it, I mean, I know it's new, but like how new is this? Like, is it something that.
I mean, it's relatively new. The problem is the ethic. What a lot of people don't realize is the ethics around doing these sort of experiments and checking it out. That's one of the reasons he said he doesn't let people with bipolar disorder be part of these tests because of the adverse effects that they've had with the microdosing. It's a relatively new, like a new field, like in the last 10 years, which doesn't seem new, but in the realm of research, that's relatively new.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so he's a big advocate, about microdosing. He was just like, we have found it effective for depression. He was very adamant about you need to be really careful if you decide to do it with bipolar disorder. And he also was very adamant about you need to have someone, monitoring it because you can give yourself too much. This is microdosing. These are little doses. These are tiny doses. So he also said you need to be really careful about that. But it is relatively new research. Yeah.
And is it, I mean, Amy, is it approved by the FDA to use ketamine?
No, it's allowed. So it's allowed. There's like two levels of approval. Something is, you know, allowed. It's not technically illegal, but it's not an actual official medication.
Okay.
The other thing is ketamine is another accident, happy accident. It was being used by the military in some cases as part of an anesthetic stack for soldiers who'd been injured in battle and needed surgery. And in the research studies, somebody somehow noticed like, oh wait, we get really much better mental health outcomes from people who've had ketamine in the anesthetic stack. for the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how, I mean, even though people have known for a long time that there was something here, it's not like hallucinogens having potential mental health benefits is super new, just that it's part of the official system is new. But that was the first kind of official research-based hint that there might be something there that we need to explore. So
yeah, because they did a lot of hallucinogenic treatments in the 60s and 70s because they were using MMDA and they were using ketamine and they were using all kinds of stuff for treatment.
But it wasn't sort of officially approved.
Yeah.
The research was kind of under the table a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's a little sketch.
So everybody's always known something was there. But as far as it's being part of something official, that was just the recognition that when people were recovering from surgery because they'd gotten injured, they had better mental health outcomes. Same way the same antidepressants were discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So,
like, didn't a lot of the research on hallucinogens and mental health start with PTSD? Wasn't that something like that they found was really effective?
That there was a lot less PTSD in people who had ketamine as part of their medication, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
There you go, the army exploring on other people again.
Look, I'm sitting here thinking, like, how are we going to get to the point of using psychedelics when the federal government hasn't approved the use of marijuana, period, for its staff people?
Oh, well, the army is different. They can do different things.
They can do lots of experiments that other places can't do.
Yeah.
That's true. She works at one of them.
Experiments. You know, I think we're back to the chemistry experiment again. Mm-hmm. And somebody who's making a decision about this needs to understand that they're participating in an experiment. Mm-hmm. Are you willing to do that when you don't even know all the downsides?
Right.
And particularly with bipolar, and our systems are so sensitive. And I'm past the experiment stage. Having said that, if I were acutely and seriously suicidal, I have said I'd be willing to try ketamine once.
And I think it comes down to that. It's like when you're desperate and this is the last thing that could help you, you know, I would try it. I would. If it was the last option, it was either that or I was going to be depressed for the rest of my life. I'd try it.
I mean, in February of last year, I went into a severe depressive episode. My spouse was living in another state because of his job, and I was ready. He was ready to come home. Like, it was that bad. I was about to have to be hospitalized, and my psych could have told me whatever, and I would have freaking taken it. I would have downed it. It was the most miserable. Like, I hadn't had a depressive episode that bad in so long. And I was in such crisis, he could have told me whatever. And I would have been like, all right, give it to me. Like, because when you're in that space, you're ready to do whatever you need to do to get out of that space.
Right.
And see, I have a problem with that. I mean, I'm glad you got out of that space, but you're not able to give informed consent at that point. And, you know, I've been in that place. And taken a drug that I had severe doubts about, because the psychiatrist said that's the next one to try, and I should not have. But informed consent goes out the window. If you can figure out ahead of time, you know, before you're desperately ill, what you'd be willing to do, what you wouldn't. And if those wishes were honored.
Well, that's like having a medical directive.
Yeah. And I think While I don't have mine written, well, I don't have mine written down in a legal document. My therapist knows whether anyone would listen to her is another question. But yeah, I think that's important that people get their education before they
get are desperate.
To the desperate stage.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because often people don't go to the doctor until they're at the desperate stage.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They're already falling apart. I mean, for me,
I thought I was stable. Like, I was fine. So I didn't think that there was a necessary, it was necessary for me to even look into other medications because Lamotrigine was doing it for me for years. It just happened to be a situational that kicked off that depressive episode. And so, I mean, what would you recommend for people who think they're stable and they don't know, like in my situation?
It would just be a matter of, I think anyone who has bipolar has to count on the fact that a remission is not forever. And that we need to prepare for the possibility of relapse.
I think that's true. And I don't think enough people realize that remission is, it's just that it's temporary. Like, it could be years, it could be months, but either way it's temporary. And like you said, Willa, there's going to be a relapse. I was one of those. Like, I thought I was fine. I was stable for so long. Like, nothing was going to happen. I was going to be just fine. And I wasn't, you know, for a long time, I wasn't. And it was scary because I hadn't been like that in over 20 years. You know, you go 20 years being stable and then all of a sudden bipolar kicks back up and it's frightening. Like, you don't know what to do. I didn't know where to even start again. You know, you have to. Thankfully, I had Steven to help with, you know, talking to doctors and things like that, because you're just not in the headspace to do that. But remission isn't forever.
You know, it just, it occurs to me to just to say to the listening audience that if you're not hearing LaShawn's voice right now because she's left.
Oh, yes. LaShawn had to leave. She had a family engagement.
But Eugene hasn't had a chance. I don't know if you've been wanting to jump in at some point.
I'm actually just soaking all of this in because but I think probably the two things that stuck out to me was when we talked about the correlation between different things like bipolar and ADHD and all that being family related. And that really kind of stuck out to me because, and so I began to start thinking about our family and other families and how that all kind of plays in. But mostly I'm just kind of learning so much and understanding that the role that I play in it, while I may not have experienced it firsthand, I have people in my life and people that I know and friends who are going through it or who have gone through it. And I understand that me holding a space for them, anything that I can do as far as, you know, informing them to give a second opinion or even just kind of like listening. So I do understand the role that I play in it as just somebody that can be sympathetic of it, put myself in their shoes and just kind of hold a space for them experiencing that, because I am kind of just, I don't understand and I can't relate to it. So it's, I'm enjoying listening to you all as the experts explaining it to me. So here soaking it all in, but somebody who doesn't know anything about it, but I can still relate to it because I have people in my life that are experiencing it.
It occurs to me, I mean, as you were talking, I suddenly remembered there are programs that train barbers to deliver mental health care. You know, not just community-based mental health care and hairdressers, you know, certainly do that.
Yeah, I call myself a therapist. I mean, I get so many people in my chair that are experiencing so many things And they just kind of need to talk. And so if the 45 minutes to an hour that they spend with me gives them some type of peace of mind or take them away from whatever they're experiencing, I'm grateful that I'm able to do that. So
it's interesting because when you think about that kind of creative delivery of care, I mean, what better place could you, I mean, you're in a prime space. Mm-hmm. To then pass them a business card and say, call my friend at so-and-so if you want to talk more, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, mm-hmm. or like Amy was telling us about in Chicago, the guy who, what is it,
Coffee, hip hop, and mental health.
Coffee, hip hop, and mental health. You know, it's so mm-hmm. creative.
Yeah, so it's basically a coffee shop that has turned itself into a community center around mental health issues. And there's another one called Sip of Hope on the North Side, where every employee is trained in mental health first aid. So somebody actually comes in fully in crisis, they would know how to push that, how to handle that, to push that person to the next step in care. So
mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. can buy their coffee online for Sip uh-huh. of Hope.
Yes, you
and
can.
And they'll donate to mental health care. Uh-huh. Yeah,
that's cool.
I bought it. Yeah.
Nice. No, somebody will have to come to Chicago and we'll do a show from there.
Yeah, we keep talking about that. We have to, you know, mm-hmm. get in our cars and maybe yeah. now that like Jeremy is home, we can mm-hmm. all do that and get up to Chicago when the weather is nice.
Uh-huh.
Eugene, when you coming back across the
maybe
pond?
Maybe check out when Chicago, when Coffee, Hip Hop, and Mental Health is Health's next gala is I think it's in April.
Ooh.
Because tickets go fast.
Really?
Wow. Uh-huh. I couldn't get into last year's.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, you know, we're coming up yeah. with 2 hours now in the summit, and I don't know how many topics mm-hmm. we have left. I can't remember now.
Yeah, I think hallucinogens was the last official the last one.
Yeah. Wow. So, well, what another action-packed 2 hours. We'll have to split this up.
Yeah, you have to split it up.
Yeah. You know, in two parts, you know, for sure. Or either just put up a two-hour episode and just...
No one's going to listen to that.
Agree that we're not... Yeah, no one's going to listen to 2 hours. They'll look at 2 hours and be like, oh, this is too much.
That's too much.
Yeah. So I'm going to break it up in hour-long, you know, 2 hours. We'll just do two parts. But wow.
Thank you, everybody, for being here and giving us your Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I know
thank you for having us.
You could be doing so many different things.
That's true.
And you chose to spend it with us.
So let's do one last round robin of final thoughts, and then Amy, we'll save you for the end.
Okay.
Honey, do you want to start this time?
I think we touched on a lot of good topics. I think that they're important topics. I think it was a good conversation. I think we got through a lot, and we got a lot of different perspectives.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Eugene?
Yeah, again, thank you so much for having us, but even more than that, personally, thank you for the information. Now I know a little bit more about some of the issues that are faced in the mental space community. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being on, and thanks for all you do as a therapist.
I've
told my own stylist, like, she is definitely part therapist.
Yeah.
That's for real.
Yeah. You know, and who's taking care of you, Amy? I'm glad you have someone taking care of you. Mm-hmm. A therapist.
A therapist.
So that.
Yep. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Right. I love it. How about you, Megan?
I think it's just important not to give up. I think that mm-hmm. was something that we kept talking about, because it's so easy to give up when you weren't given the right medication and you had a bad reaction like me, and I gave up for many years and was very anti-meds because of it. It's really easy to give up. It's really easy to give up in the sense of like suicide. When you're in that place, it's so easy. Like mm-hmm. it's overwhelming. And so I think people need to know is, like, remind yourself that at one point in time it was better and it can be better. And so not to give up in the general sense, like mm-hmm. just keep advocating for yourself.
I always like to remind people and to remind myself that we are cyclical. And so mm-hmm. when you get really down and you get really depressed, like, you're going to come out of it. You have to. It's just the illness. You're not going to stay there for forever. You're going to swing back. But, you know, don't drown yourself in it, because you'll come out of it. You always will, especially when you're bipolar.
It always will change.
It'll always change. How about you, Willa?
Oh, you know, I think I'd love to have a deep dive at some point about to go deeper into the community concept.
Yes.
That our current fractured communities and our isolated communities and our God help us nuclear families, which are like these little pressure cookers for all kinds of dysfunction, are creating our mental health crisis. Community, I think, is a much, there's a lot more possibility there for healing that therapists and medication are never going to touch.
Yep. How about you, Amy?
Yeah, take us home.
Just that one of the biggest things that's been on my mind lately, and especially with this discussion, is we are at a certain point in history where psychology is new and psychiatry even newer compared to other sciences, other spiritualities that psychology is based on. We're babies. Other spiritualities, sciences, everything, philosophies, everything that's gone into psych, thousands of years old, but a dedicated attempt to solve these problems. So new and experimental. And that's unfortunate sometimes, because there are so many things we still need to know more about and get better at. And the biggest thing is to keep things pushing in the right direction so we can grow, change, improve, get this field to where it people need it to be.
Well, thank you guys. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. I know it's a long show, but we like to have these for you guys. I think you enjoy them. I hope you enjoy them. The numbers say you do.
As we, yes, the numbers say you do. And as always, we want you to use the website. I'm actually redesigning a new Bipolar Girl Beyond website.
Steven's got a new website coming out.
For, and to reorganize things a little bit. And, so yeah, so hopefully use the website, all of their resources, links to Megan's show, links to Willa and the Prozac monologues. And I think we've been put the Cousins Trip podcast up there too. So you can get and see their show. You can see Amy's books. You can link to purchasing her book. And so yeah, thank you again for, you know, helping us create community. Take care, everyone.